On today's College Football Inquirer, Ross Dellinger has a story about a 51-year-old case that could have implications for schools today. The NCAA is trying to rein in this eligibility lawsuit situation. There might be a very old tool in the toolbox that they may be trying to use, which, of course, might lead to a little more lawsuits. We'll talk to Ross about that. Plus, I ranked the top realignment moves of the 2010s. Yeah, I read Bill Moose's book, started thinking about Nebraska and the Big Ten. Then I started thinking about everybody else that moved in that time, tried to figure out who won it and who lost it. We'll talk about all of that today and more on the College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey. I am Andy Staples, and Ross has dug deep into the files of the NCAA, into NCAA legal lore, as it were. And Ross, you have a great story out at On3 today about a 1975 court case that could have a lot to do with schools today.
Yeah. I didn't physically dig through any files, Andy. I didn't go up to Indy and dig through the dusty NCAA files, but that would be something. I'm sure there's an NCAA headquarters archive somewhere, right? Which must be pretty fascinating to...
That building's huge. There's got to be something like that.
There's an archive somewhere. But in that archive, I'm sure you would find the details of the what's called the rule of restitution, which basically just allows the NCAA... It was created, as Andy mentioned, in the 70s, 1975. And it was used for the first time in 1976 in a case where a basketball player, Lonnie Shelton, of Oregon State, signed a pro contract, then returned to college, sued the NCAA to get his eligibility back after signing the pro contract, and won and got a preliminary injunction, led Oregon State to an 18-9 record in the Sweet 16 appearance in 1976 NCAA tournament. And then the during trial, a few months later, the NCAA won and the preliminary injunction was overturned. And so the NCAA could then use its rule of restitution, which is adopted the year before, which permits the NCAA from punishing a school or an athlete if it wins or if a injunction was overturned. And so now, speed up 51 years, and we have a lot of similar cases going on, eligibility cases going on, including one very similar, obviously in Alabama, Charles Bediako, that we talked about on the pod quite a bit, played 5 games under a temporary restraining order and then had a preliminary injunction denied. But there's more than that, right? There's 6 to 8 football-related eligibility cases working their way through the court system where the football player was given a preliminary injunction, played. Most of them have completed their eligibility now, but their court case is still ongoing because the preliminary injunction is only temporary to the trial. So, and one of those, which is fascinating, I sort of stumbled upon, lo and behold, was the college football national champions, Indiana, who played a safety, Lewis Moore, who was granted a preliminary injunction to play this past season by a court in Texas. That case, the NCAA's appealing, and it's still ongoing. So fascinating if the NCAA actually does what it threatens to do in these new legal briefs, which is to impose the rule of restitution and vacate wins if it wins these court cases.
And it's interesting because the question I got the most during the Bediako stuff, and especially after the judge in Tuscaloosa overturned he didn't overturn. He had a temporary restraining order. He did not grant the injunction that Bediako was seeking. But I am reading the temporary restraining order right now. And I got to say, Bediako's attorneys looked through the same crates you dug through, Ross, because I'm going to read this verbatim. The defendant, National Collegiate Athletic Association, Inc., is further restrained from threatening, imposing, attempting to impose, suggesting, or implying any penalties or sanctions on Mr. Bediako or the University of Alabama or its coaches or other student athletes as a result of Mr. Bediako's participation in Division I athletics competition under the rule of restitution, NCAA bylaw 12.11.4.2 or otherwise. So this is why people keep asking, and it's interesting, Ross, you did not really in your story mention that Alabama was going to get hit with anything, even though they would be the obvious one that would get hit. They won three games. Like, you could vacate those three wins right now. They won three games with Bediako playing. You could vacate it. And if you did vacate those three wins, you kind of make Alabama a bubble team, I think. Like, it would definitely change their NCAA tournament profile. So, but if I were the University of Alabama and I had this piece of paper, well, this digital PDF at my disposal, and the NCAA tried to do that, I would sue the living crap out of the NCAA.
And I don't think, before I turn to Godfrey here, who I'm sure who has comments, I don't think anything happens to Alabama. And I quoted in the story a couple of attorneys. One, Darren Heitner, who is represented Bediako in the case, who believes that if the NCAA were to impose the rule of restitution, there would just be more lawsuits and they would lose that battle in court. But I think maybe even more noteworthy is the other attorney, Scott Schneider, who's a Texas-based attorney, does a lot of NCAA stuff, says that the granting of the preliminary injunction didn't necessarily vacate or nullify the temporary restraining order. The temporary restraining order just expired.
And you're supposed to obey the court when it says something.
During the order, right? Now, what makes the Bediako case differently is that, right? All these other cases, preliminary injunctions could be overturned during trial. So that the NCAA could have more of a reasoning to impose the rule of restitution. So I don't expect anything to happen to Alabama. Here's what I do expect, as I kind of hinted to in the story. I think the NCAA selection committee, whether it's from the NCAA, others, themselves, I don't know, will take into account the three losses, not Alabama, but the three losses to the teams that sustained the loss with Bediako. So Auburn, A&M, and Missouri all took a loss when Alabama used Bediako. And I think the NCAA selection committee will, I don't want to say exempt that loss, but they certainly in their mind while they're deliberating will remember that Alabama was playing using an ineligible player in those losses. By the way, Auburn, A&M, and Missouri, basically all on the bubble, I believe.
Yeah, they where they sit in the SEC standings right now would put them pretty close to the bubble. And that's fascinating because this is a situation where one game might be the difference between whether you're an at-large or a first four team or whether you're out completely. Like, that is that probably is the easiest way to handle it, the cleanest way to handle it, where you can say, hey, we didn't think you should be playing this guy, but you're not going to get yourself sued. But yeah, they've got to get this figured out. And Ross, we talked about this a little bit earlier. The five to play five, the reason they won't do that is because they're afraid of everybody suing who is essentially suing now, who only got 4 years of eligibility. I don't know what you do, but the only way out of this is to get rid of the waiver system entirely.
Yeah. And yeah, which say, five for five would do, right? It would get rid of waiver. Yeah. It would get rid of red shirt. It would you'd get rid of all that because all of this is based around the subjectivity around a waiver process that some would say is inconsistent.
So I'm curious though, like if Ole Miss plays Trinidad Shambliss, and theoretically, and I'm using theoretically to do a lot of heavy lifting here. If Ole Miss plays Trinidad Shambliss this fall, could the NCAA come back and say if they lose that case or if they win that case, could they come back and say all of that's invalidated? Or could they do something in the middle of the season even and say you got to get them off the field?
Let's turn to our Ole Miss correspondent.
To what possible benefit? To what possible benefit? Why are we doing this? Why? Why?
I can tell you why. You want to hear okay. why?
Give me a quick summation for the audience as to why the NCAA is wasting its time doing this.
These people like banging their heads against the same concrete wall over and over. They enjoy it.
The interminable challenge of co-hosting the show is finding a new way to say the same thing when Ross comes in with it, with original, exclusive, hard-earned reporting that the NCAA is doing NCAA things. I struggle to manufacture something unique of it. Andy, it's like we need something where we can just kind of point, like the way that, like, if you're in an Alabama courtroom and they got the Ten Commandments up, we just got to, like, it's this.
They were in an Alabama courtroom and they won. Which commandment won in the Betty Yacko case?
I mean, okay, sure.
No pro players after playing in college.
One thing that is really interesting about the details within is that they seem hell bent on not changing their fundamental approach to so many aspects of governance and legislation, if we can still call it that, because they're so powerless relative to 10, 20 years ago. That stands out to me. The other thing that really stands out to me is how excellent the NCAA is at inventing a problem and then also sort of simultaneously presenting themselves as the solution to that problem. And Betty Yacko is probably the strongest example yet, wherein they finally, we talked about this for weeks, Andy, they finally found a case in the court of public opinion where they ended up just by default earning the trust of the public back, in that
they're on the side of the public in this case. Yes,
for the first time ever, yeah. They end up on the side of the angels, and they've squandered that by taking the developments in Chambliss, for instance, and then potentially Aguilar, and then on and on and on and on. Whereas we have summarized and theorized and not really debated, because I think we're all sort of a logical mind. It's not really a side to take. You could make an eligibility amendment, some sort of catch-all proposition, X to play Y. We've done this segment 3 times in like a month, so I'm not going to go back.
If you do 5 to play 5, you have to accept that there will be a class action lawsuit filed. Like, the second it's filed, you have to start talking about the settlement. You just decide what you're willing to pay to do that.
Right. So I struggle to analyze this, or I struggle to present this in terms for the common fan, when the overwhelming summary here is that we're still talking about deck chairs on the Titanic.
Well, but that's what it is. Okay, so here's the thing, guys, and this is going to sound harsh, but it is the truth. These people at the NCAA would like to continue getting paid.
Yeah, definitely.
They have jobs. They have, you know, advanced degrees. They have well-paying jobs. They would like to keep getting paid. Mm-hmm. If they don't do stuff like this, the only people at the NCAA office who need to be employed are the ones who stage the tournaments.
I never wanted to leave Blockbuster Video. It was a great job when I was 16.
Yes.
I would be hard-pressed to run a video store today. I would love to sit behind a counter and tell everybody, give pithy comments and make
VHS recommendations. Is that Blockbuster in Bend, Oregon still open? Do we know?
No, I think it closed.
See, you have no hope, NCAA. If the Blockbuster in Bend can't make it, you got no hope.
What would be?
Oh yeah, that was a great was a Netflix documentary,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah,
the last Blockbuster.
It was a Blockbuster.
The irony of that being a Netflix documentary, yeah, not lost on me.
I can feel the shock collar going off on me getting off topic, but like I could, yeah, I spent 3 years in the Blockbuster mines. I still have the memorized sales pitch. If you would like an Ericsson cell phone, gentlemen, What I would throw back to Ross, I think there's orders of magnitude in development. And when the NCAA is posturing, I post-Alston, Ross, you tell me if I'm perceiving this incorrectly. Post-Alston, a development like this or a news story like this, their actions feel so semantic relative to the fact that my understanding is that they're hanging on by a thread, because the moment the Big Two decide they don't want the governance, or they can simply do without, there won't be an NCAA. Big Two, I'm talking about the Southeastern Conference and the Big Ten.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and speaking of that, and that's what I wanted to get to is a good segue about the SEC. About a month ago, I think we addressed it briefly on the pod. Several SEC university presidents, athletic directors, and the sitting commissioner, Greg Sankey, sort of went on the record with me about the lack of national enforcement and the inconsistency in the eligibility rulings, and that they are contemplating moving governance and enforcement into the conference office, like kind of the old days where the conference investigated, enforced, and made its own rules. Now, there's a lot of issues with that we can get to later. But
the SEC,
one of
the SEC used to have its own PI, guys.
A lone investigator. Yeah, that's right. Investigative department.
We're going to Netflix? You go to HBO? You want your 10-episode prestige dark comedy drama?
Yeah.
It's the SEC PI working in the 90s.
So I think one of the reasons, Andy, that they... Well, one of the reasons they at least are voicing this publicly, they're talking about it privately, is because of the eligibility situation. They think that they're a small enough group in the SEC to not have market power, and they can maybe create some rules and enforce those rules, including around eligibility, if the NCAA cannot. I'm saying all that to tie back into this, what the NCAA is doing is partly pressure from the SEC and others to do something about the eligibility issue and to take a stronger stance. And this is their way in doing it. I don't know that it's going to work, but it's certainly a deterrent, or they're trying to get a deterrent.
Let's take one step back, Ross. Let's take one step back.
Yes.
And let's take that at face value, that the SEC is pressuring the NCAA to do something. If you follow Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is often the correct one. What's actually happening here is the SEC is forcing the NCAA to expose how inept and feckless it is now, so that they have a mandate to move on. This isn't conspiratorial. This isn't a tinfoil hat. But at the very top of the league, and even across the aisle, I know they don't have the best relationship with the Big Ten right now, but I don't think it's a Cold War status either. The more that they can privately pressure the NCAA to publicly expose its own fecklessness, the better the move is going to look when they announce a separation.
Right. And
did anyone else watch Succession?
Well, the Dabo thing, this is not the SEC, this is coming from a different place, but the Dabo thing, when he publicly outed Ole Miss, when he went after them, that whole press conference, that wasn't to get satisfaction. That wasn't him walking up with a glove and smacking Pete Golding across the face and saying, I demand satisfaction. That was him and Graham Neff, Clemson's AD, very calculatedly, which is probably not a word, saying, I'm throwing all this out there so that when you do nothing, we can say you're powerless and we can start moving on to whatever the next thing is.
Correct. You also you introduced a bit of visual imagery there that I have to now talk about on the microphone, which is the idea of someone who had to bartend and break up fights in Oxford for a very long time. The idea of Dabo Swinney, an individual that looks like Dabo Swinney, an individual that looks like Pete Golding fighting in a bar, is the most Oxford thing that one could summon.
Frat versus frat.
Oh my God.
Dabo Swinney, though, walk on, who actually wound up starting games in the SEC. I'm telling you. Say whatever you want. Make fun of the pants. He's a dog. Don't get in a fight with him.
No. I don't doubt him. He's the overzealous Sigma Chi at Ole Miss who's really worried about public procedure. And then Pete's the Fidel who doesn't show up to anything because he's been following Panic for a year and a half. But he's still got enough high school football player in him. He also has a lower center of gravity. Dabo is, every time I'm around Dabo, I do note, I was like, he's taking care of himself.
Yeah.
And that's just about a fight like that is like, who's going to bite the other one in the face first?
Exactly.
When you're rolling around, like when you get real dirty.
But that's the thing. There's no fight. That's not designed for a fight. That is designed to show that the staff of bouncers like you can do nothing here. You're powerless.
I mean, you can smack somebody on the head with a mag light. Trust me.
Oh. Here's the thing about what the SEC is considering. and doing all this stuff in the conference level is, well, one, as Andy mentioned, it could be quite, it could evoke quite drama things that Greg Sankey, I'm sure, would want to avoid in the league. But two, the SEC would be doing all this with the under the idea that they don't meet market power and can't be sued under antitrust for enforcing some of this stuff. And a lot of lawyers would say that's not going to work, right? That they do have market power.
I would
explain.
Say that,
hang on.
I'm not a lawyer, but I would say they don't, because there is a league that makes more money than them that is essentially, I mean, they're equal. They seem to have at least one major competitor, and I would argue the ACC and the Big 12 are similar.
Explain market power.
If they're not all working together.
I think most people probably dipped on market power.
Yeah. So the reason that the SEC is talking about this going in-house is that the NCAA continues to get sued over antitrust, obviously, that their rules are against the law by having the market power, the National Association, without basically any real competitors, and that their rules are monopolizing.
I think the legal term is actually monopsony, which I thought was a made-up word.
The SEC is small enough that they won't get sued in court for antitrust violations because they're a small enough group and they're not sort of a monopoly. That's the thought. And this has been talked about. I think lawyers within the league have told administrators, last time I heard, that that might not be the case, right? They may have market power and they may be under antitrust scrutiny, just like the NCAA is, which would defeat the purpose in doing all this. Right?
So let me take it back out in a broader sense. I want to kind of correct myself, because for the last couple of years, I considered Alston to be, you know, the Archduke Ferdinand that starts the historical change, the shot heard around the world. I think in actuality, it's not. I think it's a precursor. And I think we're living in this liminal space.
Does that
space.
Make it the Lusitania? I'm.
What is this, a Michigan podcast?
Yeah.
All right. So you have the precursor event now that is destabilizing everything. And essentially, it's like when you go, remember those spinning newspaper headlines of the 40s where it's like, Europe on the edge. That's like NCAA on the edge. We don't actually have that Archduke Ferdinand moment yet, because what Ross keeps describing every single week when we talk is there are actions being taken by instable parties that have no alliance with one another. And we're waiting for something to tip this over the edge, really from a labor standpoint, so that potentially entities like the SEC or the Big Ten or whatever comes next in a Super League concept are kind of freed from some of these shackles. Because I think
what tips it is the quote unquote grownups going at each other. And it hasn't actually happened yet. But what I mentioned about Betty Ocko, like if the NCAA tried to vacate those wins, Alabama would sue the NCAA immediately and say, how dare you? We have this judge's order right here that we were complying with the law. How dare you punish us for complying with a court order? And so that hasn't happened. To Ross's point, let's say the SEC were to do this. I would say and guess, I'm just guessing here, that Alabama or Tennessee or Ole Miss or whoever it is would be much less likely to sue the SEC than it would the NCAA. Because once the schools start suing the governing bodies,
their own league,
it's over.
I think that goes back to your Mike's Live thing. Yeah, that's your Mike's Live thing, Andy, that you taught me years ago, which is like the reason why the SEC maintains its power today was that Slive was this grandfather gangster who basically informed all these warring factions at the time. And this is a pre-Red River, obviously, you know, SEC. You are more powerful as a combined unit than you will ever be as individual brands, and we will always act accordingly, which is why when the Sankey era started off and you had like hurricane fights between LSU and Florida, that was something that was in such stark contrast to the way that Slive ran the SEC previously.
But early in Slive's tenure, you dealt with that stuff too. And before slightly before Slive got there, like I'm old enough to remember being at SEC Media Days when Philip Fulmer...
I was there, dude. I was there.
...was on a speakerphone if he set foot in the state of Alabama, he was going to be served with a subpoena.
That was my first SEC Media Days. I was a student reporter and I was like, is it always this dumb? And people are like, yeah, kind of.
Nick Saban's dog shows up sometimes.
I mean, yeah.
Well, Slav is the one that I think got rid of Andy, the investigative
enforcement. He did, because it was causing
at the conference level, because
it was solving.
Yeah, because the AD meetings were like fist fights. It was just ugly.
They still are. Yeah. I think it's the ability to maintain a lot of that in behind closed doors. It's really what you air publicly that I think defines the SEC and its ability to stay unified. I don't foresee one of those individual institutions trying to challenge the SEC. They would definitely try and challenge the NCAA. And this is why I go back to Andy. Again, Bediako only exists. He only ever plays basketball for Alabama because of the NCAA. Because of the Alston case, because of eligibility, because of the liminal space that we find ourselves in between now semi-pro and pro, and now we're paying kids, and now eligibility is able to be challenged in courts. It is a problem that the NCAA's inaction developed, and now they are trying to insert themselves as the solution. I want to say one more thing about my alma mater, because we said this off mic, but I do believe it's worth saying on air, because Ross, we were talking about this as we were setting the segment up. This is a response also to Chambliss, correct? This is an internal push because of the way
the timing of it when the briefs were filed was the week before the hearing in Trinidad Chambliss unfolded, which tells me that maybe there was some kind of, hey, we'll get this out there that Ole Miss knows if they play him, we may plan to do this at some point.
Yeah, there was, this is not a conspiratorial take. I have no love for my alma mater. I was making fun of them on social yesterday for basketball attendance. There is a hilarious sort of never-ending feud between that institution specifically and the NCAA. And I think it's kind of the gross, like, flagrant conduct of Ole Miss and its booster core and everyone else in public in flaunting some of these rules. It's very like 1980s Miami.
Well, I go back to your great story on
there's a few
that
of those, like Miami.
Whole investigation into the Hugh Freeze era stuff, but the t-shirts. And if I'm the Ole Miss people, I'm holding that grudge.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
If I have a chance to stick it to them, I do.
Well, I think the newsworthy part of this, Andy, is that no one would be shocked if I said, yes, there are still people in corners, check writing corners of Oxford who hate the NCAA. But I could also say that about, I could say that about Gainesville or South Bend or even Ann Arbor. What the news is that I followed up with a lot of primaries on that case, which is now close to 10 years old. People who have left the NCAA and gone into private practice, most of them are lawyers, overwhelmingly, they still talk about, like, those NCAA enforcement agents are not robots, they're not automatons, and they absolutely had it out because of some of the things. I mean, the most famous incident is the Hugh Freeze tweet. If you know, don't slander our young man, hit compliance at early issue. That was, to use the Gen Z parlance, when that came across the desk in Indianapolis, I've had three different individuals who worked in enforcement say, basically, they were like, they saw that and they went, bet. Like, all right, let's go. You want to challenge us? Absolutely. And that was before Tunsil and the gas mask and the draft night and all that. So I do find that it's just sort of this hilarious, never-ending kind of like television show between these two warring parties. And I did think it was funny. We mentioned this, I think, Ross, that they bolted out of the courtroom in Pittsburgh before the reading. It felt very sort of dramatic stakes of a TV show. Like, okay, they're going to regroup. Like the posse will be back with more numbers.
We saw this morning, by the way, the judge in that case did issue a show cause order to the NCAA to explain why they left. So we'll see that filed, I guess, at some point.
There is something so humorous about it. I think we've all been near a committee on infractions hearing. I know none of us are supposed to be there when it happens, but I've been extremely close to one.
I'll leave it at that.
Once in a while, you have been in one.
Yeah.
So we're all very, very familiar here, and we could probably do an entire show on how histrionic the Committee on Infractions hearings are, and how it's very much a kind of like iron. It just reminds you of like probably what a criminal court would feel like in the Soviet era. And then at the moment the NCAA gets pushed into real live court with real live lawyers, it is amazing how fast they tuck tail and run. That has been a historical constant.
Listen, Godfrey, they had to get to Knoxville. Stock and Barrel closes at like
another
nine on a weeknight. I mean, you want to get a big nasty in before you have that hearing the next morning.
One might argue they've been getting a big nasty in for a while.
And if you just got destroyed in court in Mississippi, like the whiskey selection will help soothe your nerves before
they
you
didn't
go to
get
court
destroyed
in
Tennessee. We're still waiting for the judge to rule.
I'm guessing they did okay in Tennessee.
And by the way, when they do, maybe I'll pitch to a future segment here. because I live among so many Vols and I've had this question posed to me, I'm now asking, this is just a football question, guys. Is this a good thing if I'm Tennessee? Is this a good thing? We don't have to talk about it today. You got 2 5-stars mm-hmm. sitting on that roster. This is not mm-hmm. Trinidad Chambliss or, mm-hmm. you know, let's we got a scratch and dent Deuce Knight to fix up.
We had this discussion on the On3 show the other day because that is a hot topic on the Tennessee message boards. It is,
I mean.
And there are.
Yeah. You got a kid in George McIntyre who's like the next great hero of Tennessee football. And then you have another 5-star.
Based on Brandon. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, actually. Let's talk about that later in the show. It's a good question.
Okay. Sure.
So next up, though, I ranked the realignment moves of the 2010s after our discussion about Nebraska maybe trying to move back to the Big 12 in the Bill Moose era. It's fascinating. I don't know that many people wound up happier. We'll do it when we come back. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and our discussion and my reading of the Bill Moose memoir inspired a new ranking. Because thinking about Nebraska and where it is in the Big Ten now, and the idea that the sitting AD at one point, and this would have been in 2020, in November 2020, Bill Moose says he met with Bob Bowlesby, who was then the Big 12 commissioner, about potentially returning to the Big 12. Now, there was not support among the entire Nebraska administration for this. Obviously, they're still in the Big 10. But I got to thinking about all those moves made back in the 2010s. And so I ranked every realignment move of the 2010s. Now, this is not the recent stuff. So like Texas, Oklahoma, Oregon, I think they're fine in their new conferences. They're happy. But let's give it some time. We've now had 10 to 15 years of these other moves, of Texas A&M and of Pittsburgh and of West Virginia and Nebraska and Maryland, where do they all land? And guys, my number one with a bullet mm-hmm. was Texas A&M. I think
you,
they're the happiest
about
this.
Weren't you
in
the documentary about this?
I remember. SEC Ready? With, I sure
yeah,
was.
Yeah, I remember when you were in a documentary that Texags did. Yeah, no disagreement, by the way. I think the only thing that there's maybe like you take a couple points off is that Texas, they didn't bolt the
Texas
door behind
is now,
them. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Yeah. They made the move partially to get away from Texas, and here comes Texas 8 years later.
See, I don't think that is the problem. I think the problem is they can't beat Texas. Like, all they got to do is beat Texas, make that a real rivalry. Don't let Texas have, because remember now, because of all this, Texas has 16 years of bragging rights. They've only played 3 times, and Texas 3-0 in those 3 games.
Yeah.
But because there was that big gap, but Texas A&M completely reframed its identity by being in the SEC. I liken it to Texas was the older brother. Texas A&M was the younger brother. The older brother goes off to college. The younger brother hits the weight room. The older brother comes back from college like, holy crap.
Yeah.
That's what happened. Like, but until Texas A&M is beating Texas on the field, it's not complete. But I do think Texas A&M is very much happier now. Let's just go through my list, and you guys can tell me where you think I'm wrong or where you think I maybe need to explain myself. So I had Texas number one, Utah number two, even though they're not in the conference anymore that they moved to.
Wrong. Wrong,
wait,
Andy.
What's wrong?
The people at Utah are hell-bent on... We're hell-bent on staying in the Pac-12, right?
Why?
Sure.
More than anybody, they wanted to stay in the Pac-12.
Really?
The president wanted to stay in the Pac-12. The administration wanted to stay in the Pac-12. Like them and Arizona State, right, were the two in the move to the Big 12, and they were just like, we don't want the Pac-12 to collapse. We want to stay as much as we can.
But they're still better off now than they were in the Mountain West.
Yeah.
And they still have achieved more.
For sure.
They achieved more than any... Yeah. Anybody who jumped from a what we would call back then the non-BCS leagues, anybody who jumped from one of those to a power league, and that includes TCU that made a national championship game. I had TCU.
Yeah, I mean, their move from the Mountain West, obviously, yeah. That if you're looking at it from that standpoint, that's true. And really, let's just be honest, like, their move to the Big 12, they should be better set up in that league.
to
yeah, yeah. They immediately got to the Big 12 as one of the better programs in the league. Yeah. Now, the first year because of quarterback stuff, but last year they're the third best team in the league. They go 10-2. Now we're gonna find out how much of that was Kyle Whittingham and how much of that was program infrastructure.
Mm.
But I suspect a lot of the program infrastructure.
Don't name a coach in waiting. I would. You are actually now arguing against yourself in my eyes because I think Utah and TCU almost under those stories to me are linked together for the historical reason. TCU maybe might be number one, Andy, because think about being left. Think about being deserted. I wrote a long story.
They won like four conferences in 6 years or something. It was crazy, right?
Well, okay.
They accepted Big East or something?
WAC. They went WAC, Conference USA, Mountain West. They were going to the Big East. They never got
there. Minutes. There's logos there is logoed merchandise from TCU. Yeah.
I was at a Big East meeting in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida, where TCU showed up. But then they get the call from the Big 12. And obviously it's the most natural fit in the world. And it was because the Big 12 had to move fast. This was to replace Texas A&M. They had to replace Nebraska and Colorado a year earlier. They lose Texas A&M and Missouri in rapid succession in 2011. So that's TCU and West Virginia. Now, the other one, like TCU was the obvious one. Perfect fit. Worked great there. They've been awesome in the league. The only reason I had them below Utah was they've been slightly less consistent than Utah. They've had more ups and downs. But they've been, like, they're a perfect fit in that league. I had Missouri at number four, which Missouri felt like a weird fit to the SEC when it happened.
Yes, it was a warm body.
Well, no, it wasn't that. It was a state that they didn't have in the footprint, and they were trying to.
Yeah, but let me push back a little bit.
Increase the footprint because they're starting a cable network, and it was peak cable.
Yeah, but I mean, St. Louis as a TV market is not that powerful. They had A&M. That was the get. It honestly reminded me of we've got Arkansas. South Carolina, get over here. Like, it was kind of the same thing back in 91.
You guys remember the other state said no, so let's get South Carolina.
You guys remember the option B to Missouri, if Missouri said no or something happened with Missouri. Do you remember who had the next offer?
No.
West Virginia.
That's right. Yeah.
Oliver Luck had West Virginia in the SEC. He still to this day said Missouri. Something had to happen with Missouri or they had to say no or something. I was up there. I was a Missouri beat writer when they made the transition. I was living up there in Columbia. And let me just tell you, it was an interesting time to see them just going to the SEC and the reaction sort of around the community. I think at the time, there was just a lot of confusion of, why are we doing this?
Well, they wanted to go to the Big Ten, and the Big Ten didn't want them.
Yeah, the one thing I wanted to bring up was they really had designs on being the next Big Ten school.
And they actually make some sense of like as far as when you compare them to other Big Ten schools.
But here's the thing. As strange as that move seemed at the time, it has actually aged well. Gary Pinkel was in a really good place. We don't appreciate Gary Pinkel enough. He had Missouri in the SEC championship game in 2013. That was
second
a
year
fun
in the
as
league.
Hell game against Auburn, by the way.
Back to back, right? Didn't they
back
go in 13-14?
SEC championships.
And then
they got whacked in the game championship game both times, I think.
But. No, Auburn. They were in the game against Auburn.
They were competitive. Yeah. Okay,
they almost won the SEC.
Well, the Barry Odom years were not as good as they wanted. But Eli Drinkwitz has put them on really good footing, and they feel like a very solid member of the league. Like, I don't think it's weird when I see Missouri playing an SEC game anymore. And I we'll get further down this list. So you can read the list at on3.com, but I have Maryland 12th of 13 on this list. Like, I still think Maryland should be an ACC school.
Yeah.
It looks wrong to me. But Missouri, reason, it's okay.
You have Maryland and Rutgers at the bottom, and I think that goes without explanation. Then right above the
Syracuse.
On the bottom, Syracuse
too. I mean, they're all those three, Syracuse, Maryland, and Rutgers, put them in whatever order. Feel like the bottom three of realignment. You know.
There's a lot of frustration because Syracuse might be the true basketball driven entity on this list, other than the UConn conversation we can have in a second. There's a lot of resentment among Syracuse that they're in the ACC.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and that's the question I want to ask you guys. So I have UConn number six, and this is when I texted my coworkers at On3, and they're like, why is UConn so high? And this comes actually from a conversation with the godfather of this pod, Dan Wetzel. He had a really good conversation with Reese Davis on his show this week about all of this stuff. And Dan and I got on the phone afterward and probably had another pod on the phone. But we both agree on UConn. And a lot of it is because Jim Mora got me drinking the UConn football Kool-Aid when he was there, made them very competitive when they played ACC teams. If you are a UConn fan, are you happier now with your lot in life, your school's athletic department and what it's done, than Syracuse, than Boston College, than Maryland, than Pittsburgh?
Probably those, yeah. Yeah, you
can I call back to think.
Then West Tuesdays, Virginia, if we're going to go with other former Big East schools?
Right.
I can't remember why we talked about this on the last episode, but sport-only membership. That's what we're talking about with Saxton and all that.
Yes.
Yep.
Football-only stuff, yeah.
Just bring back.
Basketball-only stuff, maybe with in this case.
Yeah, every school that you just named would, at least their donors, their alumni, their fan base, I'm not saying the school presidents would put this on Front Street, would welcome a return to the Big East, the true Big East basketball conference.
Basketball, for sure. Yeah,
and that's absolutely what UConn did. And it was very bumpy with the independents in football at first, but they've now figured out that part of it, how to schedule
Yeah.
I mean,
if you think they
need to get in a conference, right? They know. I think they need to get in a conference for football pretty soon because they're the last independent outside of Notre Dame was.
But they don't need
CFP.
To be in the ACC, and they don't need to be in the Big 12. And here's why. Here's why. If you'd like to keep winning national titles in basketball,
don't go to the Big 12.
Sure they do not cannibalize your basketball program by forcing your football program to spend money to be the 12th best team in a 16-team league.
Yeah.
Put them in the MAC.
Yeah, it's Syracuse, too. Like, I feel like Syracuse people would be a lot happier had they just done what UConn did and done football independent and stayed in the Big East for basketball.
Well, Reshare has created this weird dynamic where, Maryland's a good example. Maryland's in the Big Ten, which is considered the Tiffany Conference. Maryland lost its basketball coach, Kevin Willard, a year and a half ago, because this weird dynamic has emerged in the rev share era, where if you're at a quote unquote football school, you can't spend the same on basketball than if you're in like a Big East school. So he goes to Villanova.
Yeah, you feel the need to invest more because of your peers who are you playing every week in football. And you need to invest more in football, and then that leaves basketball out. And that's why right now there's a real concern. I know we talked about it on the old pod, like last spring. This is a huge storyline, is that the basketball schools in the Big East, 4 to 5 of them, are going to spend 10 plus million on their basketball roster.
I'd much rather coach in the Big East than I would in the Big Ten, unless I
can't do that necessarily.
Michigan. Yeah.
So the Syracuse thing is interesting to me because part of this is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, but Syracuse has really warmed up to the potential with Fran. It's also how long can we keep him?
But that's the thing. If Fran has one good year, he's gone because he already had one good year.
He had one good year, but he had it out of order. If he had the one good year this year, I think he would have been gone and started off with this.
But if he has another good year, people will realize it's just because Steve Angeli got hurt last year. He's a really good coach. He's gone.
Syracuse wants... I would say Syracuse wants to have more relevance in football. I think UConn could take it or leave it. But UConn also is hoisting national championships, whereas Cuse has not in recent years. I do think this is a... carve-out is a good way to describe this. Mm-hmm. I do think these schools don't want to be made fun of for prioritizing basketball first in a football-dominant media culture, which this is a football program. I'm a football writer. I don't write about basketball. So I would give them what they want here because... I'll throw this in just as an acknowledgement because we're a very regionally biased, just by default, podcast. If you think the pomp and circumstance of whatever college football game is fantastic, SEC championship, you know, Ohio State, Michigan, whatever, the Big East basketball tournament at Madison Square Garden used to be one of the best sporting events in the entire country. And it was torn apart by football.
Yeah, the Big East people still get after it in the current iteration of the Big East. Like, Providence fans are nuts.
Yes.
They are SEC football fans. They're just smaller in number.
But they want, Cuse will never admit it. UConn will never admit it. They want Cuse in that league. Yes, they want Providence in there. Yes, Seton Hall or St. John's. Yes, that's fine. But bring back Syracuse And to that end, absolutely. By the way, like the football product was really good for a long time. I understand that certain schools are never coming back, but let's talk about Pittsburgh for a second on this, because that's the hardest one for me to.
I had them
really
right
have
in the
a
middle.
Take on.
They won the AC, they've won the ACC. They've only been truly bad 1 year, and that's 2023. They've been pretty good, so I think they're probably happy with it. The basketball part of it, they got, you know, Jamie Dixon goes to TCU. They stopped making the Kevin Stallings was like the worst hire you could possibly make. Jeff Capel hasn't been much better. I think that's hire dependent more than conference dependent, though.
Right.
Like I think with the right coach, they could be good at basketball too.
I think that's the Mendoza line of your.
I think
of
you're
your
right.
Suggestion. Yeah.
Because I have Pittsburgh number 7 below UConn. I want to go to Louisville at number 5, and here's why. Mm-hmm. There's an alternate history. Ross, you mentioned that West Virginia was the backup for Missouri for the SEC, which Missouri was never going to say no to that, so it wasn't going to happen. Yeah. But there was a time. So remember, we said TCU gets plucked to go to the Big 12 to replace Texas A&M. Missouri is decided. We already know Missouri's going to the SEC at that point. So the Big 12 is trying to figure out who the other team they bring on board is alongside TCU. They get it down to Louisville and West Virginia. Chuck Ninus, according to people who were involved in this, now Chuck Ninus had not with us anymore to defend himself, but
yeah,
Chuck was the
story,
the interim commissioner, allegedly said, "What matters is access to an airport." For those who don't know, if you want to go to Morgantown, you fly into Pittsburgh. Mm. That's an hour away.
There's
you
one flight a day from
the runway of the Louisville Airport from campus.
There's one flight a day on United. You can take one, or not one flight a day. I'm sorry. There's one flight a week on United from DC to West Virginia. You land in the little West Virginia airport, and it's like a 25 minute flight. You know, right. Ooh, over the Blue
shout
Ridge
out.
Mountains,
shout out to Louisiana Monroe. They have a better setup than that. Delta flies there every day. So does American.
But so
yeah, West Virginia's
tough. Despite this being allegedly the number one criteria, West Virginia gets picked for the Big 12. My argument is, if Chuck Ninus selects Louisville for the Big 12, everybody's happier, because Louisville would have been just as good in the Big 12 as they are in the ACC. It would have fit just fine. It probably all would have worked out the same way. They would have won some games. Jeff Brohm's still going to wind up there as the alum. He'd be winning in the Big 12 right now. Their basketball program, well, the Kenny Payne hire was terrible, but they'd probably
was that
be
national,
pretty.
They, was the national title is in the ACC or the Big East when they beat Michigan?
I believe it was the last year of the Big East, the Patino
okay.
one.
I can't remember.
I think it was 2013?
It's 2013, but I don't. Yeah, I don't. I wouldn't
yeah,
know,
so they joined the ACC in 2014. So this would have probably, and then because West Virginia would have been the obvious choice for the ACC when Maryland left. And I think West Virginia being the odd geographic fit for as long as it was in the Big 12 was one of the things that hurt West Virginia a lot. And like that's the one what if. I think everybody would have been better off had they picked Louisville for the Big 12 at that point.
Louisville was the case study for a long time because, and bear with me, I'll do this quickly. There's a lot of sociological sort of study here in the late 70s all the way through the 80s. When a lot of these metropolitan areas fall apart completely economically, people start moving to the suburbs. This is also when the land grant schools and the SEC and the Big Ten become bigger and bigger in enrollment. And the perception was, especially in the Mid-South and the Appalachia areas that we're talking about, was that these city schools, they were losing enrollment. They were considered dangerous campuses. They didn't have a lot of like new building. There wasn't a lot of new infrastructure to support it. And Louisville was the case study to turn the perception of those schools around, mainly because of Papa John and a couple key donors. The city got behind it. There's really, it's a study of alignment, and we use that word a lot, where the university, the athletics, private money, public money, state reps, local reps, everyone got together and basically said, we are going to push Louisville back into relevance, right? And so that's why you saw the construction of a new football stadium that you can see, which is what right next to the airport.
Tom Jurich, by the way, in the ultimate gangster move, just telling the Big East, we're leaving. Like 4 years out.
Yeah.
Like, we're leaving on this date. I don't know where we're going, but we're leaving.
It was brash, Andy, but also you could see the aspiration in the funding of the projects. And also, the way the city was talking, the way the university was talking, there was an alignment there that Memphis has never experienced. Memphis has always been the bridesmaid of realignment and will probably continue to be so because they were just recently rejected by the Big 12. Ross mentioned that on Tuesday. Louisville was the case study. Even I went to TCU right after they joined the Big 12 and did a big long story about the Revivalry. By the way, everyone hates that name, but I think it's cool to say. Chris Del Conte was talking about it. Like, Louisville was a case study. Even now, TCU did not lack for cash. They lacked for organization and, I think, emphasis. By the way, the reason why I love college football is, like, we go back to where TCU is on this list, Andy. They're still mad at Ann Richards. They're still pissed off that the governor of Texas shoehorned Baylor into the Big 12. That's something that people still talk about. So,
well, if you had to go to the WAC in Conference USA, you'd be mad too.
Imagine annexing, but like, it's so funny. Ann Richards was the governor of Texas at the time, was a female Democratic governor in Texas. Look it up. It happened. And basically, as they were loading the lifeboats to destroy the Southwest Conference and create the Big 12, which was basically a merge of the Southwest and the Big 8, she nudged in Baylor in, over TCU in Houston because she was a Baylor alumnus. And what's this is so amazing was, do you guys remember the old Baylor football stadium? Like,
oh, yeah.
It was a
Boyd
joke.
Casey.
Baylor was in no way deserving of that. It was just good old fashioned American politics. It was fantastic.
And that is what a lot of this is. That's where a lot of this comes in. So
yeah,
I look forward to 10 years from now when we're ranking the Texas and the Oklahoma and the Oregon and the UCLA and USC moves. But it's interesting to look back on this. And again, realignment probably more destructive in terms of what's happened to college sports than NIL, than the transfer rules, than the lawsuits, and anything. But
I thought it was players getting paid, though. That's what the senators are telling me.
Well, because they're hearing it from the people who caused realignment, who would like not to be blamed for anything. So
what?
Yeah, I know, right? It's crazy.
Don't be a conspiracy theorist.
But let's get back into the NIL world, and it's sort of the NIL world, but how it intersects with the football field, the eligibility lawsuit world, and how it intersects the football field, because you raised an interesting question at the end of the first segment, Godfrey, about the Vols.
Oh, yeah.
Joey Aguilar, their quarterback, is fighting for his eligibility in court. He's also going to the NFL Combine, which is a bit of a tell. Tennessee has two very high-profile recent quarterback signees. When we come back, let's discuss, at what point do you move on? Do you turn the page? Or at what point do you stop signing these very expensive now high-profile high school quarterbacks and just decide you're a veteran QB program? Let's talk about it when we come back. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and earlier in the show, Stephen Godfrey brought up something very interesting. We were talking about all these eligibility cases, and of course, Joey Aguilar, the Tennessee quarterback who came from Appalachian State by way of UCLA, who was in JUCO for a long time.
City He's College to get of San Francisco? Year. Is that right? City College
that
of San
was
Francisco?
One of them, yes. Yeah. Yes. He is trying to get an extra year of eligibility. The judge who held the hearing last Friday has still not ruled as we record this on Thursday morning.
Which is interesting, by the way. Very
yes,
interesting.
Indeed, Ross. It is very interesting. Also very interesting.
To deliberate. He took a lot longer to deliberate than the Mississippi judge.
Do we know where Correct. He is? Do we have proof of life? Or is this like, are we in conclave or what?
But here's what's interesting about this one versus the Trinidad Shambliss situation. The Trinidad Shambliss situation, the Ole Miss fan base, the Ole Miss coaching staff, everybody united in the desire to have Trinidad Shambliss play quarterback for Ole Miss in 2026.
Yes.
I think if you polled 100 Tennessee fans, I'm talking about hardcore, like message board fans, I think more than 50% would be like, well, can't we just see Faison Brandon and George McIntyre? Can't we just see what we got here? And I think that's interesting. And part of it is obviously Trinidad led Ole Miss to a better season than Joey led Tennessee to, but part of it is also skepticism that Joey's going to win. And also, a little bit of old school, wait a second, we signed 5 stars. What's going to happen? Aren't we supposed to be awesome when we sign the 5 stars? Why don't we just play the 5 stars?
We don't have a plan for any of this anymore, do we? We exhausted or we suppressed the patience required to develop a 5-star. See Manning, Arch. We have instituted a perpetual win now, compete for playoff spot every single year or else mentality. on about 40 schools, roughly. Mm-hmm. So, but we also haven't changed our demand on the staffs to go out and recruit the best talent either. We have expectations of Tennessee and Ohio State and Notre Dame and Alabama to go out and be the best that they can be, signing high school players, but also win right now. And also, if that transfer, whomever it is at any position, is out there, you should go get them, right? So,
yes,
all of these things suddenly occupying equal level of demand. What do you do if Aguilar can come back? What do you do in 2026 if you're Tennessee? Do you take some licks and start one of the younger quarterbacks to prepare for a 3 or 4 year future potentially? And then subsequently, by the way, so even without Joey Aguilar, it was going to be an interesting season because you have two young, talented, touted quarterbacks, alliterative there. I try. Mm-hmm. Okay. Andy, normally in that kind of situation, we're going to take our bumps, right? We're going to go through conference play. Look up their schedule. It's not super nice. You got Georgia Tech pretty early on, I think. They got someone else, I think, in non-conference pretty early. Like, it's not the breeziest, right? So in all of the other years of college football, you would pick a kid, you'd have a competition in camp, and you would go in, and then maybe if, by the way, this is not an injury scenario. This is just like, all right, well, he didn't perform well. We're going to stick the other kid in. But this 2026 season is going to be the year where we didn't really know who the starting quarterback was, and we ended the season with a confirmed starter. So the momentum and the attention and the expectation would be on 2027. If you have Joey Aguilar behind center, none of this occurs, and you are left with the same scenario in 2027, except that we all know that these two kids are not just going to sit on the bench for another year. One of them, for sure, would just leave. So how do you manage this? Is Joey Aguilar the Will Howard of your championship puzzle? I doubt it, just knowing the Tennessee defense right now. They're also, by the way, you're in a year of transition under Jim Knowles. And from a terminology and personnel standpoint, I'm going to go ahead and posit that Tennessee doesn't necessarily have a championship caliber defense ready to go out of the box.
They did bring quite a bit from the Penn State defense that played for Knowles. So they're going to have a little jump start on that. So
the championship Penn State defense.
I mean, the defense wasn't really the problem.
I mean, they weren't terrible, but I mean, again, let's level our expectation. So I don't really know if, like, this kind of feels like, be careful what you wish for. Like, all right, if you get Joey back, then you have a three quarterback problem with really there's no context for this on what to do.
Mm-hmm. No, and Heupel, it's interesting because, you know, Heupel probably is a little bit scarred from a couple of years ago when in 2023 he has Nico Iamaliava as a true freshman waiting behind Joe Milton. And the hindsight at the end of that season, well, why didn't you bench Joe Milton and start Nico earlier?
Yeah, and this is also the Tennessee fan base, Andy. Vol calls is a thing. You're right. They're not
vol
patient.
Vol calls,
I don't believe is a thing. I believe it's an RIP.
It lives on in your heart.
But I will never forget when their basketball coach, Jerry Green, said, if the fans don't like it, they can just go to the Kmart. So... Bob Kessling, the voice of the ball is nearly perfect. Choked on something.
I have a theory I want to throw out because I don't think there's an answer. We could talk around like start Joey, win now, try to transition one of the kids, lose them both to transfer. I don't know. We could exhaust all those scenarios. I have a proposal that would reach back for the last 2 or 3 weeks worth of content here. You ready?
Yep.
Let's just look to European soccer again as a way to be just disgustingly corrupt and capitalistic at the same time, because that's very American. Let's let Tennessee and Ohio State and all of these major programs annex Group of Five programs. Stay with me. All right. Here's what I'm talking about. This would solve your scheduling problems. Every single year, let's say Tennessee, who are we going to annex Tennessee? Tennessee's going to annex them.
App State, easily.
Done. Yeah. Okay, great. All right. That, by the way, Georgia Southern fan didn't say that. Okay. Tennessee's going to annex App State. They officially have an ownership stake in App State football now. We'll figure out the paperwork later. You are going to send.
There's going to be some paperwork.
Yeah.
Just so phase on Brandon. You're going to loan phase on Brandon. Lines.
No, you're loading
phase
on Brandon.
Is this like a minor league? It becomes the minor league.
What do you mean becomes? System?
It's exactly what it is. Well, yeah. But hold on, Godfrey. Officially. Okay, you're loaning Faison Brandon to App State.
I like this idea.
What App State fan says no?
Correct. So if you have a pitching rotation and you have a $25 million AAV pitcher in the major leagues, but you also have a dynamite young talent, you pitch him in double A, right? He still has to pitch. If you're going to stack the deck with transfer talent and continue to sign high school talent, the other option to this is that what are these five-star kids just going to be like, well, I guess I'm never going to get in at Ohio State or Penn State or Florida or wherever if I don't have the 2 years of experience they want coming out of the portal, but I'm a five-star. So do I sign as a five-star quarterback with like Coastal Carolina? Is that what's going to start happening?
I have asked this question a bunch on the On3 show because I can't figure out the answer.
Right.
I don't think you do because the money's still too good.
Correct.
Now, if the Ohio States and the Tennessees stop paying that money, which they might, because like I don't know what Darion Coleman is making. Do you guys know who Darion Coleman is? He's the quarterback Miami signed this year. He's highly rated. He's a four-star guy. He's the number 321 number 331 player in the class. He's the number 22 quarterback in the class.
Okay.
But Miami was previously trying to be in the market for top 10 QBs in the class. Miami has since decided we're not in that market anymore.
Right.
We're in the market for whoever the best veteran transfer we can get is.
So let's take George McIntyre, one of the highly touted quarterbacks here. Signed with Tennessee out of high school. What if George McIntyre, I can't remember the recruiting story locally, but I mean, like, wanted to be a Vol, right? Was, you know, oh, my dream is to play for the Vols, play in the SEC. If you had a partnership agreement with some G5 school and he goes there for 2 years or 1 year or whatever it takes and develops, and then again, we have your 5 year eligibility window that I've been offering, right? A five-year, like, just no qualms about it. Five to play five. Yep. You spend 2 years at App, and then you go in, you play 3 years at Tennessee. But the way that, like, I don't understand why Ohio State doesn't literally take one of the MAC schools in their own state and just say, you are our development program. In exchange, we are going to send you money. You are going to survive. You're going to play on Thursday night. Okay? Ohio University or Bowling Green, because Eddie's there, right? Eddie George. Ohio State Heisman winner is the
Absolutely.
Head coach.
Right you go down in. The road. I mean, it's a very close drive.
Okay, so Ohio State literally annexes Bowling Green and says, all right, you guys are going to play every Thursday. We're going to send you all of our five-star talent that needs to get reps. It might be for 1 year. You can't call them up during the season, so you're going to spend a year at Bowling Green, all right? But if I've got a logjam of defensive linemen or this quarterback situation in Knoxville, this is where I'm going to send them to develop.
You might have been the one who told me this. I'm not going to name names of schools because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But there was a G5 coach who was having success who may have floated it to the power conference schools in the same state. Hey, let me be your developmental program.
We've talked about this, soundly
rebuffed.
Yeah.
That would have been a good idea.
It really would have been.
Yeah.
It really would have been. Because
I'm giving you an assignment for next pod.
Gotcha.
Every power conference, I want you to assign them a farm system G5 school or G6 school.
Yes.
We need to go through the list.
This is Tuesday's show.
The two that jump
Producer
out.
Producer TJ easy, asking a very good question. How do you get the athletes to buy that? Like, for example, Tavian St. Clair, who was the five-star Ohio State quarterback who sat behind Julian Sand this year and will likely sit behind him next year. How do you tell him you're the Bowling Green quarterback now?
It's in the contract. That's what the money's for.
Don Draper always wins. But you're probably right. Like, if it is like a loan out, like it is in international soccer,
yeah,
then
it's exactly what it is.
You're still being paid by Ohio State.
Yeah. My entire vantage point on college football after 20 years changed when I read that one book, The Club, and then I started to sort of peer into European soccer, and I'm like, oh, they just put all of their corruption on the front doorstep of the institution, and it allows them to act faster, and it actually allows for innovation. The only thing holding us back is the facade that we have put up as college football, that we're still amateur athletics and this is about an education. The faster you get rid of that, the faster you can have, like,
I am loving, like, five-star Ohio State. Like, you sign with Ohio State, you report to Bowling Green.
And it doesn't, not everyone has to do that, because I know you, the three of us could sit here and name five-star freshmen who came in and mm-hmm. immediately played impactful time for a national title contender.
Do you call
contender.
It the Irk Russell Scholarship when a Georgia player reports to Georgia Southern? Like,
I
enjoy
would.
Statesboro, son.
I would. How much do you love the Dogs? Do you love it enough to go down to Bullitt County? By the way, I love
Listen,
Statesboro.
You're
going to
get
Listen,
after
don't
their
get me
asses
in trouble.
Down there, and then you can get yeah. after your asses up here.
Hey, both programs have Gatta on their merchandise, okay? So, yeah. Love Statesboro.
I love it. Well, now we know what Tuesday's show is, unless some crazy news happens. So we're not going to overpromise.
Unless when.
Well, yeah. But
Joey Aguilar's been kidnapped.
Godfrey's making that list. You're going to get that yep. list at some
hey,
point.
I love it.
Very soon right. on the show.
I want y'all to think about this over the weekend. Think about all of the schools, the supplementary schools in the state of Louisiana, and how fast they would fall over themselves to be LSU's farm system.
Mm. Well, listen, now yeah. that the Popeyes buffet yeah. in Lafayette is closed, I think, because that would have been the easy
It's closed?
Choice.
That's going to be a tough yeah. one. Lafayette, oh, you got Tulane, you got UL Monroe.
It'd be funny.
Louisiana Tech. I think Tulane's a little... Tulane's mm-hmm. going to get their mm-hmm. own. Tulane's going to get McNeese or something.
Mm-hmm. Spoiler mm-hmm. for Tuesday, I'm not including the American in this. This isn't... The American is something else. We'll have to talk about it.
Mm.
It's the middle
class.
Okay.
You got to be able to All afford right. that. That's right. Not everybody can live in the suburbs, baby.
I cannot wait. We'll talk to you on Tuesday.